From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Hosting Thanksgiving can often feel like a stressful affair. And maybe those anxious feelings are already creeping up, that you're falling behind on your planning or that you can't decide on a main course. Well, it does not have to be that way.
Inviting people in to be collaborators and not just guests makes the whole having people over experience feel more communal, and people feel relaxed and people feel like they want to be there. And that's the kind of environment you want to create, right?
That's Allison Roman. She's a New York Times columnist and best-selling author and a pro at making unfussy, craveable meals that help us enjoy each other's company. It's the subject of her new book called Nothing Fancy.
It's funny because the first sentence of the book is, or it was, this is not an entertaining book. And then my editor pointed out that it sounded like the book itself wasn't entertaining.
Today, Allison's helping me answer some of your burning questions about the big feast. You asked, we answered. So, Allison, welcome to Good Food.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, how many years have you been hosting your own?
It varies from year to year, and by my own means, regardless of who's actually physically hosting, I end up doing a lot of the cooking. So I'd say it's been about 7 or so years.
And before, who was the one who took the reins? Your mom?
My mom or my dad. And before that, it was my mom's father, Grandpa Bob.
Oh, that's so interesting. Mm-hmm. You have a paternal line of Thanksgiving.
I do. That was where we always celebrated in Tulsa, Oklahoma. That was where we grew up going before he passed away. But he was sort of the man who raised his own rabbits and grew his own tomatoes and baked his own bread, and where I learned to make turkey stock from all the necks.
Oh, I love that. So you know that we did a shout out to our listenership.
Yeah.
We begged them to call a voicemail line, which was somewhat problematic.
Yeah, some people did the tweet instead of the voicemail, but I think we got there.
Yeah, but we do have some questions. Last year, we did it with Dory Greenspan.
Oh, Dory.
So without further ado, let's hear from the first caller.
Hey, Evan and Good Food. It's Steve LaRue calling from Hodgenville, Kentucky, but also I live in Santa Monica as well. My question is, what are your thoughts on spatchcocking a turkey? I'm always concerned about having the legs and thighs, you know, cooked at the same time as the breast. And also, how do you not puncture your hand, you know, when you're breaking up the backbone, et cetera? So look forward to your reply and happy Thanksgiving.
So we should just have a little refresher that spatchcocking is when you cut out the backbone of the bird. You can mm-hmm. do it with the chicken or do it with the turkey, and you flatten it out, press it down.
Right.
What are your thoughts?
My thoughts, as a recipe writer and developer, I feel like it is my responsibility to write recipes that the most people will have success with. So this year for Thanksgiving, I did test it spatchcock, and I also tested a smaller bird done sort of low and slow and then crisped up at the end at a higher temperature. And I actually found that that was a better turkey and easier. And I think if it was just me and I wasn't telling anyone else to do it, I love spatchcocking because I love how brown the thighs get. But for the average person, like my mom's never going to spatchcock a turkey, despite how many times I've told her. But those bones are really firm. And unless you have really good scissors or a really sharp knife and you know what you're doing, it is a bit trickier than just a chicken.
Or if you're really committed to spatchcocking, you could go to a poultry butcher. Mm-hmm. There are some, I mean, here in Southern California, there are some, and there must be some in other cities, a butcher, and have them cut the backbone out for you.
Yeah. And I think spatchcocking or not, it's the size of the turkey that really matters, because a big, say, 22-pounder, even spatchcocked, you're going to have uneven cooking. So for me, I think it's about the right size bird. And then spatchcock or not, you can do low and slow, or hot and fast.
What is the right size for you?
For me, I'm looking at like a 12 to 14, I would say. 14 on the higher end. But in my turkey research, of which I've done quite a bit in the past month or two, 14 to 16 seems to be a bit more common. And that's still okay. But once you get into the 18 to 22 pounders, I just think that you're set up to fail.
Yeah. And so my method that I've relied on for the past few years is I actually just obviate this whole thing by confitting thighs and legs that I buy separately mm-hmm. a week or 2 weeks ahead. And then I get a nice turkey breast and I butterfly it and roll it up with something delicious inside.
That's also such a good option.
You don't have the whole Norman Rockwell thing, but
well,
who cares, really?
Yeah. I mean, you know.
Hi, Evan. This is Talin from Irvine. This would be my third year hosting Thanksgiving, fifth year in America. So brave. I don't have much experience, and the past 2 years, some of my side dishes ended up cold on the table. I have one small oven, and most of it is taken by the turkey. So the side dishes I prepare beforehand, one or two of them end up being cold. So if you can give me some comments on timing and how should I avoid serving cold side dishes. Thank you.
No matter how big your oven is, this is always a conundrum.
Yes.
Now, I would say if you're going to have room temperature something, it's better that that be the turkey.
I completely agree. And I think that this is a question everyone has, Thanksgiving or not, when they're having people over. And I address it in Nothing Fancy of picking your battles and deciding what is the most important thing that be hot. And for me, at Thanksgiving, I'm really only concerned about three things being hot. One is the gravy, and that you do stovetop. Two, mashed potatoes, and that's also stovetop. Three, my stuffing. Everything else, I don't mind if it's room temperature. It shouldn't be cold, but, you know, theoretically, your home or apartment is room temperature. And, you know, your green beans or your roasted squash or carrots or things like that, room temperature is fine. In fact, I kind of prefer it. So, and I completely agree with the turkey. And I think that when you are timing your turkey with everything else in the oven, let your turkey rest, because even when it's out of the oven, it'll stay pretty hot for upwards of 45 minutes or so. So you can kind of crisp up the stuffing, heat the potatoes, make sure the gravy is really hot, put that all on the table. That, to me, is the most important part.
And since I'm a very MacGyver-y person, I have used my outdoor grill as an oven by just turning it on, either gas or coals, putting aluminum foil over it so it doesn't get too smoky, and just basically using it as an oven to keep things warm. I've also put roasting pans on the burners, like basically made bain-maries, filled them a bit with water, right, and then put whatever, like mashed potatoes, stay right really well like that.
Exactly. The beauty of living in California is that you can do that grill trick. And that's almost reason enough for me to move back here.
Well, you can go out in a coat.
That's true.
Hi, Evan. This is Jaya from Los Angeles. This is going to be my first Thanksgiving as a vegetarian. And I was wondering if you had any main dish recommendations that don't have meat in it. It would be great to know a main dish that was veggie focused or something that would be just as filling as a turkey. Thank you.
What do you think, Allison?
Well, you know, good news is I think turkey secretly is overrated, so you won't be missing much. I feel like as long as you get the stuffing and the mashed potatoes, you're all set. But for me, I feel like something really beautiful made with mushrooms, and that can even be some sort of baked pasta that feels dramatic and beautiful in presentation to kind of feel celebratory, so you don't feel like you're just kind of eating a side dish for the holiday.
And I have to say, I've relied on one of Dory Greenspan's recipes for years, and that is to take a pumpkin or a kabocha squash, a delicious pumpkin, not a Halloween pumpkin, and either do it the Dory way, which is basically baking it with a bread pudding inside that is just soaked in cream or vegetable stock. And then you could add greens if you want. And it's just gorgeous.
Almost like a stuffing, but baked in a...
Yeah, but it souffles up that it rises up out of the top with a little cap. Also, this year, I learned about a traditional Armenian stuffed pumpkin where it's stuffed with like a very flavorful rice pilaf. There's like nuts and fruit and cinnamon, and it's all put in the pumpkin and then baked, which sounds incredible to me.
Yeah, that sounds really, really good. I feel like also if any of those dishes were presented to me personally, an omnivore at Thanksgiving, I would almost prefer them. So be the dish, bring the dish that everybody's jealous of.
Exactly. That's such a good idea. Yeah. Next.
Hello, Jesse from Berkeley here. First time caller, long time Thanksgiving participant. The thing that I struggle with the most on the actual day of Thanksgiving is getting everything done in time while still being able to spend time with my guests. Generally, I end up just super stressed out in the kitchen, wishing everyone would leave me alone. So I was wondering what kind of tips you have on either dishes that are a little simpler or easier to prepare ahead, just to avoid that kind of day of stress and panic in the kitchen. Thank you.
Don't you think that you should just invite your friends into the kitchen to help you?
That's exactly what I was going to say. I think when you treat your guests like participants, then it changes the entire dynamic of your experience cooking, but also their experience attending the Thanksgiving. And it's less about you serving them and them about participating in the meal, and you kind of all cook together, even if it's like, you know, take the tails off these green beans and pick the herbs and take the seeds out of the squash, things like that, that eat despite your level of comfortability in the kitchen, tasks that you can do that will help you significantly. So not only will it reduce your stress because you will be doing less, but it will also give the opportunity to actually spend time with people.
Yes, we need to give up the perfectionist martyr complex.
Yeah, I feel like asking for help is huge.
And it's so much more fun, and you can do things like ask, could you empty out the trash for me?
Oh, that's my number one party trick. Anytime anyone's coming in or out of my apartment, they're taking either the recycling or the trash down, and it is a total game changer.
Because really, I mean, you could get nothing fancy and look through the book, and you could find so many recipes that do very well.
Yes.
Made ahead. But really, just turn it into a participatory exercise.
Yeah, I don't think you need to be cooking Thanksgiving for 3 days in order to feel like you're not strapped. So just get more people involved.
Yeah, say don't bring wine, just bring yourself.
Yeah, and your hands.
Hi, this is Jordan Castle from New York. I'm wondering if I'm making stuffing from scratch and I'm making the bread first, I need to leave it out overnight, but should I cut up the bread into bite-sized pieces first, or should I just leave the whole loaf on the counter?
Mm.
Thank you.
Cut it up.
Yeah, I feel very passionately about this. First, I want to say congratulations for baking your own bread for the stuffing. That is remarkable, and I'm very impressed. And absolutely, because you want to expose the inside to dry out. It's not just about the outside. And I'm a big fan of tearing, not cubing, because I like the really irregular, craggly nooks and crannies that you get that way, but exposing the inside is the key there, not just drying out the outside.
So what I would do in a home setting is I would put out a sheet on a large table, and I would just take your bread, tear it up, put it on the sheet, and let it, you know, don't let a cat walk across it, basically.
Yeah, my cat would absolutely be on that bread, but
or you could, you know, if you need to have an animal-free zone, you could just put it on sheet pans and put it in the oven overnight with the oven off.
That's what I do. Just also to get it off my counter because my space is extremely limited.
So this new book, Nothing Fancy, what was sort of the operating principle for you approaching a second book?
I was telling people that basically Nothing Fancy is the book I wish I had written first or been able to, but felt like I needed to kind of come on the scene with Dining In, my first book, just to introduce myself and say, here's who I am. Here are the foods I enjoy. Here are some good recipes to get you started. But in reality, how I cook and how I sort of live my life is really by having people over. I very rarely just make dinner for one. I'm not a meal prepper. I'm not into grain bowls and things like that. So for me, when I am cooking at home, it is for others and having them into my home. So I felt like writing a book that really was authentically reflecting my lifestyle was the easiest way to say, okay, this is my idea for a second book. And it worked.
And what I love about it is when you say nothing fancy, you really mean nothing fancy. And you say it's not about entertaining.
Yeah, I feel like the word entertaining tenses people up. It tenses me up. And I think what I envision is matching plates and linens and something really dramatically elaborate that I'm serving as the main course. And, you know, everything's ready when people come over and everything is just so. And it's an event. You're entertaining. But when you're having people over, that can mean, oh, I'm putting out a few pieces of cheese and we're going to drink some wine and hang out. Or it can mean I'm roasting a pork shoulder and we're making beans and 5 salads and drinking 2 cases of wine. I feel like it can mean anything in between.
You do often have people come into your kitchen and help you, like we were talking about before.
I do, yeah. And it's interesting to me because I kind of approach Thanksgiving the way that I approach every meal, which is that I like to have my green vegetable, my salad-y thing, my protein, my whatever. And as I was writing this book, I'm like, oh, I should just write a Thanksgiving book because that's basically what this is. But the advice inside of it is really good for people having holidays as well because, you know, the 3 rules at the beginning of the book, asking for help, don't apologize, things like that, are really conducive to holiday or not. But I feel like the inviting people in to be collaborators and not just guests makes the whole, you know, having people over experience feel more communal and people feel relaxed and people feel like they want to be there. And that's the kind of environment you want to create, right?
I love the don't apologize because women are so good at bringing out a plate of great looking food and saying, I'm so sorry.
Oh my God, we love to apologize. We really do. Yeah, that is a direct inspiration lift from Julia Child, the refusing to apologize thing.
Yeah.
Hopefully we can take that into other parts of our lives as well.
Yes. I feel really strongly that at a time when we're publicly dealing with issues of female self-esteem, I think you've done us all a service by awarding yourself a Pulitzer for one of your recipes. I mean, many of us have had that experience of noodling around and making something and going, oh my gosh,
yeah,
this is it. So describe that chicken.
So it was a bit of a pat myself on the back moment, but I'll take it because I stand by it. Basically of just taking, you know, thinking about people cooking chicken at home and people being so obsessed with sheet pan recipes. And my problem with that sheet pan recipe is that I feel like you, especially when you're roasting something like chicken, you lose all the good bits to the sheet pan. But when you're making it skillet, you often deglaze the skillet and you use those bits for a sauce. And so I was thinking, well, why don't I just use those same bits in the sheet pan, but deglaze the sheet pan instead of a skillet? So I'm sure I'm not the first person to think of that. It's impossible. But
it's also what you deglazed it with.
I deglaze it with a mixture of vinegar, olives, a little bit of garlic, and herbs.
You basically made a dressing.
I did. Yeah, a sheet pan dressing.
Which is just so smart.
I do the same thing for my turkey recipe, which will be published sometime this week in the New York Times, but using the same principle of cooking a turkey in a sheet pan and using that sheet pan business for your gravy.
So I actually would like to have a party where I serve every one of the starters in nothing fancy. One thing that I love is that despite the fact that all of us try to eat as much as possible seasonally, and many of us eat from farmers markets, those little cocktail tomatoes are everywhere all throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
And you seem to have a particularly loving relationship with tomatoes.
I do.
Looking through.
Yeah, those specific ones.
The spicy tomato marinated feta.
Yes.
It just looks like such a great, easy, but your friends would come and go, oh.
Yeah, I knew that recipe was special when I served it to friends and they literally said that. They just kind of fell quiet and were like, what is in this? And when I told them, they're like, but what else? I'm like, that's it. It's just tomatoes, olive oil, garlic. There's a bit of harissa paste, and I've also done it without harissa paste and used chili flake instead. But the idea that you're just kind of making a very concentrated tomato jam mixture, adding a bit more olive oil to loosen it up, and then pouring it over cold feta, it is so good. And when you spread it on toast, I mean, it's not unpizza-like, I will say.
But better even.
Yeah.
Because you can control every part of it and mm-hmm. how you put it on the bread.
Yeah, I like even a little bit more salt depending on the feta, and man, is it good.
And I also wanted to thank you for having an iceberg salad.
Oh, gosh, do I love iceberg lettuce.
I love iceberg lettuce.
It's so good. And you know what? I got to say, I'm not sure that I would have ever grown to appreciate it had I not moved out of California. Because in California, the lettuces here that you have available are incredible. I used to work at the Santa Monica Farmers Market when I was a young pup. And I couldn't imagine ever needing to buy lettuce anywhere else. If it wasn't out of necessity, I'm not sure I would have grown to appreciate it as much because I definitely turned my nose up at a certain point in my life. And now I truly crave it and nothing else will do.
And I'm one of those people that thinks that Thanksgiving table isn't complete without a salad.
Agreed.
And I think this salad would actually be a perfect Thanksgiving salad.
I totally agree. I think any of these in this book, but the iceberg one especially, it's got some crushed olives, thinly sliced onion, parsley, vinegar. You can add cheese or not.
Okay, so I'm going to fangirl over one more recipe before we go back to more questions. The crushed peas with burrata.
Yeah.
Thank you for giving readers permission to use their hands as an implement.
Of course. I feel like if it were up to me, every recipe would just be done with your hands. But
and also for permission to use thawed frozen peas.
Yeah, that is the most important part of that dish.
It's like a no-brainer, but people somehow want to go and buy fresh peas when they're out of season.
Yeah, and you know, I love a fresh pea when they are in season. Nothing better. 100%. I'm all in. But the reality is that they're not in season for that long. And when they are, it's a real labor of love. And I'm down to work. I'm down to work for it. But I will also say that I love frozen peas. It's a really good product. So for half of the peas, they are just tossed in lemon zest, olive oil, lemon juice, if I recall. It's been a while. And some fresh chives. And the other half of the peas get crushed with your hands to kind of like a coarse mash. And so when you combine them and then you spoon them over torn burrata and drizzle with some more oil and some crushed black olives, you get this really nice sort of creamy pea texture, because I don't know if you've ever tried to eat peas on a salad plate with your fork. They kind of elude you constantly, your fork chasing them around. But combined with the crushed peas, they kind of all stay together. So you get a nice coarse mesh kind of texture, and then also those whole juicy peas suspended throughout. And it's just so, so delicious over cheese.
Also, it just looks so luxurious with that burrata. Okay, I think we have time for a couple more listener questions. Some of them, of course, we got in written form.
Yes.
Here's one. I am attending our annual Friendsgiving dinner, and the host always provides the basics, turkey, stuffing, rolls. I hate the host stuffing with my entire being. It's offensive, and I passionately hate it. My partner thinks it's rude if I bring my own version. Thoughts?
Well, I think if it's Friendsgiving, all bets are off. If this was like your grandmother's stuffing and she was going to have her heart broken, but honestly, if you can't do this with your friends, you should enjoy yourself. And I don't think there's anything wrong with being like, I also made my version to go along with yours, because we always seem to run out of stuffing. Make it about like abundance.
Abundance and just variety. I mean, growing up, every year we had chestnut stuffing, every year. And then when I started making Thanksgiving at my restaurant, I started making my own stuffing that was a different take. It was based on dried fruit. My mother could not deal. So every year at the restaurant, I made stuffing for the entire restaurant, and then I made chestnut stuffing for her.
That's so nice of you. Yeah, I feel like Thanksgiving is the holiday where people with opinions really come out of the woodwork. And I don't think there's anything wrong with honoring people's personal traditions, but I don't think that should mean you deprive you of what brings you pleasure.
I think you're right. It's Friendsgiving.
If you can't do it at Friendsgiving, when can you do it?
Yeah, forget it.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's another one, another voicemail.
This is Catherine Mayhew from Nashville, Tennessee. And my pathetic question is, I do not want to actually roast a turkey this year, but I'm having a bunch of people over. Is it too much of a sorry state to buy pre-sliced turkey from a local barbecue joint that I love a week before so I don't have to stand in line to get it and then freeze it for a week? Can you freeze turkey, please? Hopefully. Thank you so much.
Okay, so I think it's totally fine that you don't want to make your own turkey. And actually, pretty much every part of this, I think, is doable, except you should not get a pre-sliced turkey that far in advance. Don't you agree?
I completely agree. I think that if you call the barbecue spot and give them your predicament, I love your turkey, I just simply won't be making my own this year, will you save me two breasts unsliced and I'll pick them up 2 days or the day before Thanksgiving?
A week out is too much. I mean, I ended up Googling a lot for this question, and there seems to be a consensus that 4 days in the refrigerator for cooked turkey is like the outside.
Right.
So I think the key is going to visit the barbecue place well before and set up what you need.
Mm-hmm.
And then slice it that day.
Yeah, I bet they will leave it unsliced for you if you request it.
And I don't even think you need to reheat it. I think you can just do a sandwich spread. Mm-mm. Get some really great mustard, have some cranberry sauce, get some good bread and maybe some coleslaw.
Yeah, and just go straight to leftovers.
Exactly.
For Thanksgiving. That's actually perfect.
Oh, here's another, a good written one. I struggle to find acidic components in my meal. Not a fan of cranberry sauce. Seems simple and excessive, like the unnecessary aunt invited to dinner. I have to disagree, but anyway. Aside from lemony veggies, I see you, Allison. What else can I add to the mix?
Wow. Called out. I mean, lemony veggies are welcome to your table anytime, but I also think a salad, sort of like the, in my book, I have a perfect herby salad, sort of a story, sort of a recipe, but basically, equal parts, like a spicy green, like a arugula or even mizuna would be great, watercress, and then torn herbs like parsley, cilantro, dill, tarragon, mixed with a ton of flaky salt and fresh lemon juice. And to the point where when you pick up a leaf and you put it in your mouth, you kind of pucker a little bit. I feel like just a little scattering of that all over your plate or just in a corner to kind of nibble on between bites of other things is such a welcome palate cleanser, because I actually really love cranberry sauce, but I find that I don't eat it with any of the foods. I kind of just eat it on its own.
Yeah, I do too. One of the things that I'll bring up from last year from Dory, she has a recipe for a cut up and roasted pineapple.
Oh, Dory. You wild card.
That has jam on it. So she mixes it with jam and I think some cloves and yeah. And then you bake it. I made it one year and it's delicious. Like a compote.
Yeah.
Like an old fashioned compote.
Yeah. I feel like anything like that. I also feel like making sure your gravy is properly seasoned. And that means not just salty enough, but also a little acidic. So I always finish mine with a bit of vinegar.
Oh, that's a great tip. I love that.
And I will also say that for cranberries, I love buying the jellied cranberry in a can. And so for this year, what I've done is I've sliced it into rounds and then I scatter it with some thinly sliced red onion and fresh citrus. So tangerines, clementines, oranges, and then squeeze lemon over the whole thing. And it's almost like a weird retro fruit salad, but it is a lot more acidic and a lot more refreshing than just the regular sauce.
I feel like I want to have that for dinner sometime this week with a bowl of mashed potatoes.
Yeah, you can do whatever you want. I love that.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a true dream to be on your show.
Oh, this has been so much fun. And I have to say, the book is fabulous.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Allison Roman, New York Times columnist and author of Nothing Fancy. Thanks so much to those who sent in your Thanksgiving questions, and there were many more than we could answer on the show. I'll be answering some of them on my Instagram stories as well as our website. Just visit kcrw.com/goodfood. After the break, a visit from Sichuanese cooking expert Fuchsia Dunlop, plus a zany deep dive into one of Mexico's most beloved flavors. That's when Good Food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
When I was at chef school in Sichuan, we learned 23 official flavor combinations. The best known, it's mala way, numbing and hot flavor.
Fuchsia Dunlop is British by birth, but you could say she found her soul on the other side of the world. More than two decades ago, she made her first trip to Chengdu in China's Sichuan province. When she tried the local cuisine for the first time, her mind was expanded by the spicy, tingly flavors and new textures. That first meal made a lasting imprint, one that turned into a lifelong calling. Today, Fuchsia is known as one of the world's leading experts on Sichuanese food. For decades, she's shared her love and meticulous learning of the cuisines of China with us. Her Land of Plenty, published 18 years ago, is now rewritten. Titled The Food of Sichuan, Fuchsia brings us up to date on the region. Hi.
Hello, Evan.
Such a beautiful book. I mean, it's a completely different book.
Yes, it ended up being totally revamped. So I've added 70 new recipes, retested every recipe in the book and fine-tuned them. And then, of course, we have all those wonderful photographs by Yuki Sugiura, who shot them all in my home in London.
And truly, it's so dreamy when you have the photographs to look at. Could you give us an idea of the size of the region of Sichuan and the breadth of dishes and styles?
Well, I mean, Sichuan is the size of a European country. It's enormous. And it also, Sichuanese cuisine includes Chongqing, which is now a separate sort of province. And it's been known since ancient times as Tian Fujiguo, Land of Plenty, the original title of my book, because it has such wonderful produce all year round. And it does have this dazzling cuisine. And local gourmets say the region has 5,000 different dishes. And they may be right, because certainly after, you know, 25 years of traveling there and exploring the cuisine, I'm still discovering new things all the time. And that's one of the ambitions with this book, was to include some regional recipes from other parts of Sichuan, particularly the south, which has quite wonderful cuisine, which isn't very well known outside the region.
So one of the things that fascinates me about Sichuan food is that it's synonymous with chili, and yet chili wasn't always there. So was the cuisine always hot in some way? And if so, how did it get that spiciness?
There's a very famous quote from a 4th century text, A History of the Region, which says of the people of the Sichuan region, Shang Ziwei Hao Xin Xiang, which means the people there like flavors, and particularly spicy, pungent and fragrant flavors. And so there is this idea that the people of Sichuan have liked to season their food boldly for hundreds of years. And of course, that's very tied in with ideas about traditional Chinese medicine, because the climate of Sichuan is very damp and muggy all year round. So according to traditional medicinal lore, you have to eat heating, drying foods to drive out all that unhealthy dampness and restore equilibrium to your body. So long before they had chilies, the people of Sichuan had Sichuan pepper, of course, and also ginger, and a bit later, regular pepper, which is known in Chinese as Huzhao, barbarian pepper. But the chili only came from the Americas to China from about the late 16th century and didn't become entrenched in Sichuan until really the late 18th and early 19th century. So it's only been there, you know, grown widely as a crop for about 200 years.
And when they embraced them, they used these incredible variety of techniques to get different qualities from the chilies. Could you talk about some of these varied techniques and the dishes in which they find their expression?
Yeah, so really, although the stereotype is just that Sichuanese food is very hot and spicy, it's really about the variation of flavors. And people in Sichuan say, yi cai yi ge, bai cai bai wei, each dish has its own style, and 100 dishes have 100 different flavors. So even with the chili, firstly, they use different forms of chili. So sun-dried chilies, ground chilies, bright scarlet pickled chilies, which are not terribly hot, but have this glorious color and fruity fragrance. And also, of course, hongyou, chili oil. And of course, the Sichuan chili bean paste, fermented chili and fava bean paste. So they all have very different characters. And what Sichuanese chefs do is they combine these different types of chili heat with all manner of other seasonings, with the sweetness of sugar, with vinegar and pickled vegetables for sourness, with the tingliness of Sichuan pepper and the nutty flavor of sesame oil, and of course the umami tastes of soy sauce. And so you end up with a huge range of complex flavors. They call them fuhewei.
I thought maybe we could talk about 3 different eggplant recipes that you have that show the variety of approaching a vegetable. So let's start with fish fragrant eggplant, the photograph of which is just so enticing.
That's my favorite photograph in the whole book.
Yeah, well, I understand why.
So first you have your eggplant, your aubergine, and you cut it into strips. And then you deep fry it until it's a little golden and has a wonderful buttery texture. And then you take it out of your wok, and separately you make the sauce. So you sizzle a bit of pickled chili bean paste or just pickled chili paste until the oil is red and fragrant. And then you add some ginger and garlic chopped finely, and then stir fry them until they also smell heavenly. And then you add a bit of liquid, some stock or water, and sometimes a little soy sauce. And then you put the eggplants back into the wok and let them absorb all these gorgeous flavors. After a few minutes, you can then thicken the sauce with a sort of starch and water mixture. And then the final note of sourness. So you add vinegar and just heat it briefly to sort of fuse the flavors without losing the sourness. And then finally, you throw in a handful of chopped green scallion. And all these flavors just combine into one sort of marvelous, harmonious whole.
And then the next dish is like so austere in comparison. It's the dry fried eggplant.
Yes. So that's a very typical Sichuanese cooking technique, dry frying. So typically what you do is you cut your ingredient into slices or slivers, and then you toss it in a wok with no oil or very little oil until it's toasty and fragrant. So with the eggplants, you can slice them thinly and then toss them in the wok, and you get a slightly smoky flavor. And then when the ingredient has lost some of its water and had acquired this rather nice aroma, then you add a bit of seasoning. So that's a typical Sichuanese home dish, very humble dish, but tasty and a completely different side of the eggplant.
And now an eggplant dish that you say is, quote, more-ish, like M-O-R-E-ish. The stuffed eggplant fritters.
Oh, that's very good. And that was one of my favorites when I was a student in Chengdu. So there you have the eggplants, and the best ones are a bit thin. So if you can get the Chinese ones, which are long and thin, that's better. And you cut them into slices, but you only cut all the way through on alternate slices. So you end up with sort of two slices joined together at the base. And then into that gap, you stuff a minced pork mixture. And then you dip it in batter and you deep fry it. And again, you deep fry it until they're golden and the aubergine, the eggplant, is buttery and soft and wonderful.
So we've talked a bit about this before in other interviews, but you lived in Sichuan during a period of really incredible, dramatic social change. And you watched the life change from a very traditional life to a modern life in a fairly short amount of time. As you rewrote this book and sort of went through the recipes, ones like the one you just told me, which may be 100 years old, what do you think about the pace of change that has happened there? And are people hanging on to traditional recipes, or is just the genie completely out of the bottle and all this going to be swept away?
Well, I think Sichuan has a very lively and dynamic food culture, and it always has. And in fact, local people are always saying that it's very Baorong, very inclusive and open and tolerant, their culinary culture. And so you only have to think of the chili as an example of a foreign import that was very readily adopted by local people and used very creatively. So I think Sichuanese cuisine itself is an argument against sort of conservatism when it comes to food. And there are many very interesting changes in recent years. For example, okra, which was unheard of before, is now served in every restaurant, often with Sichuanese seasonings. So there are new dishes and new ingredients being used and Sichuanesified all the time. And also, it's quite interesting, like the chicken tofu dish, that had nearly disappeared, really, when I was a student there in the mid-90s, but is now being revived. So I think that the Sichuanese themselves are often looking at their culinary history and looking at regional dishes and reviving them. But the downside is that I think there's a real decline in home cooking, which is tragic, as we've seen in other parts of the world as they modernize. So the elder generation in Sichuan, they were really good cooks, or they still are, and they can make all the traditional dishes at home, and they usually make their own pickles, and they cure their own winter meats, you know, these wonderful sausages hanging from the eaves of the houses. But the younger generation are losing touch with that, and many young people that I know really don't cook at all, or maybe they bake Western cakes for fun, but they don't really know how to make the Sichuanese dishes.
I mean, here in the Western world, and I think more globally, there seems to be such a yearning for some young people who enjoy cooking to take the tradition of their upbringing and mix it with a bit of the globalization that they've grown up in. And they've managed to turn it into a status move to become a chef or open a restaurant as a small independent. Is that happening at all as a trend in Sichuan?
Well, I think very little, because in Sichuan, ambitious parents don't really want their children to be chefs. They want them to study. So there's great pressure on young people to study and to concentrate on schooling at the expense often of other things like cooking.
So I feel like in a way we're sort of the beneficiaries of those who do want to do that, because then they come to the San Gabriel Valley and open restaurants.
Yeah, but I have met some very inspiring young people, one or two of whom have even been educated abroad, but who've gone back to Sichuan and are reviving family businesses of artisanal food production. And that's unusual, but I hope it's the start of a trend. But I think what's really interesting is that quite a lot of young people who are coming to the West, young Chinese people, are then becoming inspired by their traditional food culture in places like America and Britain and opening restaurants and serving traditional food. So that's a very interesting development. And perhaps some of them will end up going back to China and sort of opening restaurants there as well.
In the cooking school that you studied in which you were the first foreign student and one of only three women during the time of your course there, is that school still open?
Oh, yes, it is. And it's now moved out of Chengdu and has a big, impressive campus at a town just outside the city. And yeah, I mean, they offer training in Sichuanese cuisine, in other Chinese regional cuisines, and even in Western cuisines. So yes, it's still going strong.
Well, that's good to hear. It's such a lovely book. I'm really glad that you went to all the trouble to renew it and that the publisher agreed that it needed those beautiful photographs.
Yes, thank you very much.
That's chef and food writer Fuchsia Dunlop. We've been discussing her cookbook, The Food of Sichuan. Now for something a little different. For many native Angelenos, the mere thought of chamoy makes one's mouth water. It's Mexico's fruity, sour, salty, savory, spicy flavor combination, most commonly presented in a bright to deep red sauce. Some say it's flavored with apricots, some say plum. Chamoy is elusive, it's hard to define, and its origins are distant and uncertain. Richard Parks III investigated this beloved flavor in a recent episode of his gastro comedy podcast, Richard's Famous Food Podcast. Here it is.
Chamoy. That's right, chamoy. Whenever you're ready. It's Mexico's ruby red, fruity, sour, salty, savory, spicy flavor combination. It's used in street-side snacks like tostilocos, with sorbets and raspados, even as a seasoning rim for drinks like micheladas. And it's drizzled atop fresh fruit cut to order on the street. The mere thought of chamoy makes one's mouth water, and its bright red BMW 325i color means it's unmistakable to the eye as it coats your lips and fingers and you slurp, suck, and savor each and every flavor, calling out,
"Chamoy, yo te amo más mucho."
Cut. Yeah, we're not going to use that one.
RFFP.
Thanks, ladies. The thing is, nobody seems to really know what it is. Chamoy. Yeah.
What's
I'm trying
thing?
To figure out what it is.
It's pickled plums.
Es dulce de tamarindo.
It was originally a sauce made from dried apricots.
Plum or an apricot.
I feel like it derivates from, like, chili.
Chamoy is actually the plum.
The Mexican plum, because American plum is too much different.
It can be, like, a liquid flavoring agent kind of thing.
Dry plum, too.
Plum and sugar.
But it's not sweet, though.
Le da otro sabor.
It can be both sweet and savory, too.
¿Sabes lo que es tamarindo?
Tamarindo.
Como tamarindo dulce.
People say it's tamarind.
No. I don't see the relationship in between plum and tamarind.
How do you call pickle in vinegar?
Fermented.
In the spirit of the picle, let it ferment a little bit. Some lime juice.
Syrup.
Messing around with salt.
And maybe some sugar and maybe some fruit.
And the chile.
It's kind of all over the place.
And I should know this, because it's my heritage, but I'm not quite sure.
I don't really want to tell you what I put in there.
Así se llama chamoy, no sé cómo lo preparen.
Anyways, anyway.
So on this episode of Richard's Famous, we're going on a voyage de la chamoyage on the streets of L.A. in search of the definition and meaning of Mexico's superlative flavor combination. Hopefully, by the time we're done, I'll be able to make my nephew Turner a chamoy boy. What is chamoy to those who love it? Where did it come from? And where is it going? What is it, girl? Don't worry, I can speak a little Espanol. Right, I'm not fluent, pero...
Actually...
You know what? If I have to, I can always throw out a little of the old Tu vas, ustedes vayan. No, girl. It's...
Tu vas, ustedes vayan.
Anyways... Hang on, let me try that in Spanish.
Ni al caso.
Ritmo, sabor y cumbia. Welcome to L.A., the most Mexican city in America. With roughly 20 million residents in the greater L.A. area, the dominating country of origin is Mexico. And you can feel it in the flavors and the colors of L.A.'s culture and cuisine. Here, chamoy is as common as a traffic jam.
Hi, my name is Risa Lopez. I'm the co-owner of Que La Getza Restaurant and author of Oaxaca, Home Cooking from the Heart of Mexico.
When I think of chamoy, I think of candy. I think of childhood. I think of tangy. I think of spicy. I think of every flavor that if you are Mexican or Mexican-American, you grew up loving as a child. I just absolutely freaking love chamoy. Like my mouth, even it's watering talking about it.
Like a tiny rainbow, the bright, multicolored umbrella appears, the unmistakable sign of a fruit cart. One of a countless number that pop up streetside on the daily all across L.A.
Hola.
¿Cómo estás?
Bien, ¿y usted?
Bien, bien. ¿Qué te voy a dar?
The fruit is as colorful as the umbrella shielding it from the L.A. sun. Bright yellow pineapple, deep red watermelon, oranges, papayas, mangoes.
¿Sí? ¿Cómo okay. te lo preparo?
Con chamoy.
¿Y chile? Claro que sí.
Everything is fresh. Everything is cut to order.
Estoy grabando. ¿Está bien?
Ah, está bien. No problema. ¿Cómo te llamas?
Ricardo.
Ricardo. Okay. Yo me llamo Norma.
Wearing gloves, Norma reaches into the glass-walled ice chest and slices the fruit into bite-sized chunks, which she layers into a transparent quart-sized cup.
¿Y usted de dónde?
Yo soy de México, sí. De la Ciudad de México.
En México, chamoy es...
Ah, es mucho, muy rico. Miguelitos, paletas, cerveza con chamoy. Mucho chamoy.
And on top of the fruit, she adds a few slices of cucumber, which prompts me to give her a business card.
¿Qué es eso?
Yo como... ¿Cómo se dice?
Pepino.
Pepino.
Now the cup is filled to overflowing. Norma seasons it with salt, the juice of two limes, and a generous glug of bright red chamoy from a liter jug. Last, she adds a dusting of tajin, the dehydrated lime and chili spice mix that plays rainbow sprinkles to chamoy's caramel sauce.
El chamoy es agridulce.
It translates as bittersweet.
Okay, muchas gracias.
Gracias. All right, now I'm going to enjoy a little bit of this fruit.
The chamoy and the tajin add acidity, sourness, and a spicy kick to the cold, sweet fruit. While eating, I fall in with one of Norma's other clients.
All right, so my name is Charlie. I'm from South Central, 51st and Wall, all day, every day. And yeah, I'm just a regular kid coming, I don't know, to a building with my mom. I don't know what I'm doing here, but yeah.
Waiting for your mom, having some fruit?
Yeah.
You get a lot of fruit snacks?
Yeah, all day, every day.
So how is it?
Smacking, so good.
What do you look for when you get fruit on the street?
It has to have some lime, chamoy, and tajin.
How important is the chamoy to everything?
It's everything, man.
For someone who's never tasted chamoy, how would you describe it?
It's like a Mexican candy, like the best thing in the world.
Do you see a lot of that on Halloween when you go trick-or-treating?
Well, where I live at, so it's like the hood, so yeah, we see a lot, but like around here, like it's like better now. It's all Central. Represent all day, every day. Yeah.
Cool. Here, let me give you a card. I'm recording a podcast.
You know me. Gotta be networking all day, every day.
At Richard's Famous.
Represent all day, every day.
Yeah, so it's Richard's Famous Food Podcast.
My thanks to Richard Parks III for sharing this excerpt of Richard's Famous Food Podcast. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to hear the full version of the episode. After a short break, the Market Report. Don't go anywhere. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Now for the Market Report, here's Jillian Ferguson.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. When it comes to produce, there is no one I trust more than Karen Beverlin. Karen is the Vice President of Specialty Produce for Fresh Point, but many of us know her as the Produce Hunter. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Jillian.
So, Karen, before we get into what's in season right now, can you tell us a little bit about what a produce hunter does?
Well, I don't know what all produce hunters do, but in my case, I'm responsible for shopping the farmers market and identifying items that I think chefs would like, and then either getting samples of those items into the hands of our chefs or just saying, here, you should buy this. And trying to be seasonal and stay in really close contact with the farmers so that we know when something's coming, because we always want to be first.
So needless to say, you are an expert in shopping the farmers market. And Thanksgiving is just around the corner, so I thought today we could talk about pumpkins. Do you have a favorite type of pumpkin that you like to recommend to your chefs?
I do. I like two kinds of pumpkins, European pumpkins in this case, one that comes originally from France and one that comes originally from Italy, and then orange kabocha, which is a Japanese pumpkin. Those are my two types, three pumpkins.
Two types, three pumpkins. Yeah. All right, so walk us through each one.
Okay, so Marina di Chioggia is my favorite Italian pumpkin, and it's super unapproachable looking. It's like the oyster of pumpkins. So it's super bumpy all around, and it kind of looks kind of gnarly. It has super thick walls, but it's delicious. And it makes amazing puree, and the texture is beautiful. And I did have a really fun experience with that. I read somewhere that the best baked potato, baked russet, is if you brine it before you bake it. I'm like, oh my God, that's genius. So I decided I was going to brine one of these big, huge pumpkins. And when it went into the brine, I called a chef. I called Michael Cimaresti and said, what kind of brine do I use and how long do I brine it for? And so he said 3 to 5%. So I did 3 because, you know, I'm scared, risk averse. And I brined it, but I brined it for like 6 hours. And then I baked it whole in the oven at like 325 for, I think, 4 hours, just until it was fork tender. And it was beautiful. It's like I cut a wedge and it came out as this beautiful wedge, and then I could just like scrape the seeds out, and it was delicious. I do think I'm going to try brining for longer, but it was so fun.
All right, so take us to pumpkin number two.
Okay, pumpkin number two is originally from France, and that's Mosquée de Provence. The Mosquée de Provence is much more beautiful than the very sad looking Marina, but it's as super highly lobed, you know, so it's got deep, deep crevices all the way around, and it just looks kind of elegant. And it can be green or have a tinge of orange or be kind of a solid taupe. So it's better on color, and it caramelizes beautifully because it has a good sugar content. This is another very thick-walled pumpkin. Our final pumpkin is super popular, and it's delicious. So there are two kabochas that are here at the market. There's green, and then there's the orange. And the green is more vegetable kind of focused. It tastes more vegetable-y. But the orange has higher sugar and is delicious. And it has thinner walls, but the skin is edible. So that's super nice.
Yeah, makes it very easy. So at Thanksgiving this year, how is pumpkin going to appear on your table?
My mom does Thanksgiving and does a wonderful job, in case she's listening. I'm gluten-free and my daughter's gluten-free. I bring gluten-free cornbread stuffing. My brother is responsible for pies at Christmas. And so he brings pumpkin pie. So that's how it shows up. But in my home now, I have pumpkin bread that I made with, I have a super old family recipe from my aunt, and I made pumpkin bread with dates and pecans. I've been doing like slices or chunks of pumpkin with lentils and like some kind of greens and then like tahini sauce on top for dinner. So I think that we should all embrace pumpkin all the way through fall and into winter, instead of just holding and saving it for Thanksgiving.
I think that's a great idea. Karen, every time I talk to you, I learn so much. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jillian.
That was Karen Beverlin, Vice President of Specialty Produce for FreshPoint. If you're not following her on Instagram, you should be. It's at FP Produce Hunter. Mike Roberts is a farmer with McGrath Family Farms up in Camarillo, and he is one of the farmers who is bringing the European varietals that Karen just talked about to the market. Mike, we're looking at two pretty gnarly pumpkins in front of us. We have the Chioggia, right? The Marina di Chioggia.
Marina di Chioggia, the Italians have told me, but you might be right.
And then this one here is what?
Musc de Provence,
okay.
French variety.
So the Musc de Provence, or Mousquet de Provence, right, is an orange fleshed pumpkin here, and the Marina di Chioggia is a green warty looking pumpkin here. How long have these been in the ground? When did you guys plant these?
So these are the brainchild of one of my farming mentors, Phil McGrath and Paul Thurston, and they've come up with all these, discovered a lot of these different varieties, again, influenced by Karen from Fresh Point and all the chefs that she works with and we work with. So we put these in the ground in May, June, and then they're going to grow for about, they take a little bit longer than a traditional pumpkin or squash, maybe closer to 3-4 months, and then we'll let them cure in the field for about a month to really get that flavor and color, and then we bring them to market after that. And I'll say Karen has been pretty much cleaning us out this year, so we have definitely, you know, some for our, of course, our loyal customers here on the table, but she's been really supporting big time this year with these.
When you say you let them cure in the field, are they still on the stem, or do you cut them and let them sit in the field?
The curing in our context is cutting and then piling them together and then just letting them cure. So it's nothing fancy. We can pile them in the field or put them on the back of trailers. If we need to get back into that land and plant it again, then we would put it up on a trailer, move it, let it cure on the trailer, and we could plant again. If we don't need that land, then we could just let it cure right there in the field.
So when they get to market, they've already been cured?
Yes. That's a good question. People ask a lot, how do I know that they're ripe or ready to go? And I say, once we bring them here, they're ready.
And then when people get them home, how long will they last for?
This is another great thing about these squash. As you mentioned, they're so striking, beautiful, and in a warty way on the Marina di Chioggia. And the Musse de Provence looks like a Cinderella-style pumpkin. So you can sit them for fall decoration throughout the whole fall season. And then whenever you're ready to cook them up, just slice away and cook them up. So it's months and months they can continue to cure as an edible decoration in your home.
All right, great. Well, thank you, Mike.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
That was Mike Roberts. He's one of the farmers with McGrath Family Farms up in Camarillo. Come and check out his pumpkins at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
That's it for this week. In case you missed any of it, please listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. As always, you can subscribe, we would love you to, on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And please leave us a review if you liked what you heard. My thanks go to the Good Food team. They are Nick Liao, Laryl Garcia, Joseph Stone, Chuck Previtary, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Jacqueline Kim, Laura Kondarajan, and Amy Ta. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with more good food.